do we heal these big rifts in our systems?
I went in with my eyes wide open, ready to learn and listen.
There's no co-designing without co-deciding.
All of these difficult questions are polarities, two options where choosing one or the other is always a mistake.
There is more movement than I think people can see.
Our elders enable us to see further.
Wherever we are in an organisation, we do have the power to contribute to some change.
Kia ora and welcome to episode 70 of Beyond Consultation. Very good to have you here, whether you're on your commute or maybe you've ducked out of the office, wandering around the block, you need to pick me up. And I've been on the road a little bit the last couple of weeks with client work, facilitating one and around the country. And the other thing that is exciting me at the moment is I've launched or, relaunched some masterclasses that I have crafted and delivered over the last couple of years in all sorts of different ways, shapes, and forms. And I'm calling it the Spring Forward series. It is for teams who need a little bit of a pick-me-up after winter. So there's three topics. First is the conditions for co-design. Co-design gets thrown around like a buzzword a lot, especially in government and community organizations, but it is not a buzzword. The problem is a lot of people use it to describe things that aren't co-design, and they don't put the conditions for co-design in place. Things don't go how they wanted to, and then they go, oh, co-design, it's just a buzzword. So this masterclass is for teams who want to get on the same page about what co-design really is. The second topic is on strategic questioning. I love questions, and this podcast is such a good way for me to hone my spontaneous question asking skills. But so many of us fumble through questions and we never really get taught how to use them effectively. So this masterclass, it looks at why it's hard to ask good questions. And I unpack three elements of what makes a good question. And we do some practice on that as well. So that's the second topic, strategic questioning. And then the third one is power trip. Because we've all felt powerless in our work at times. There's so much that is out of our hands, whether it's the restructure that's happening to us, there's some kind of hidden agenda underneath things, or maybe suddenly your work program is a political football. Oh, there's a funding change. Oh, there's some sort of public debate going on, and now all of a sudden you're on the front page of the newspaper. All these things can cause us to feel like we don't have that much power. So this masterclass is about expanding your understanding of power and shifting your perspective about the power that you do hold and giving you some language to talk about power in a way that is practical and useful alongside the theoretical grounding that you need as well. And I had a funny moment this week where I sent out the launch email for these three masterclasses. And then a couple of hours later, I got a phone call from somebody saying, oh, I've been asked to introduce co-design into my organization, but I've been told I can't talk about power and privilege. Can I do that? Can you talk about co-design without talking about power and privilege? And I said to them, I think you already know the answer to that question. Because power, privilege, politics, those three Ps, they influence so much of our work. And that is my very long segue into today's episode and today's guest, because we talk a lot about power imbalances. The context for this conversation being, how does a philanthropic funder use its power, its resources, its influence to enable systems change? So we are very lucky to have on the show Natalia Sexton, who is the general manager of Weave, which used to be the Working Together More Fund. That fund was established in 2009 when four family philanthropic funds came together and said, there's got to be more that we can do to support collaboration where it's happening. They changed their name recently, and I was curious to know what was the real story behind that. So we get to hear that story from Natalia, and it's a shift really to funding longer-term projects with deeper relationships and really looking at some of the power imbalances and the equity issues that sit underneath. I must have been asking some good questions this episode, because a couple of times Natalia said, oh, that's a good question, Paul. Questions like, what does systems change mean to you at Weave? How do you decide when and where to do your work? How are you integrating equity into your approach? How do you use your power as a funder? And how do you support flourishing in Te Ao Māori? I learned a lot from listening back to this episode with Natalia, so I'm really pleased we've got her on the show for you. So please give a warm welcome to Natalia Sexton.
Kia ora, Paul. Ko wai au, ko whakapuna ki te mātou, o mātou, tiki tiki a taranga te maunga, ko te wairo, hopu hopu, hongenge, mangatangi rau te awa, ko takite me te waka, ko Ngāti Kahununa ki wairo, me rongomai wahine o ki iwi, kei te puaha o Waikato, te tokainga, ko Natalia Sexton tōku ingoa. Hey, we're working together, aho, e mahi ana, he kai whakahaere mātou, aho. Kia ora, I'm Natalia.
Ooh, kia ora.
East Coast. and lots of parts of your story resonate with me as well. My mother is Māori with Scottish ancestry, so I'm a McAndrew.
Ooh.
From Wairoa.
Right.
but my surname from my father, I'm a Sexton. We're French and Irish, so...
Yeah, yeah.
From County Cork in Ireland, so Bordeaux in France.
Yeah,
so that's where my grandmother on my father's side comes from. I live at Te Puaha, and a bit like you, fell in love with an amazing man from this area. And we did something similar. We sort of met, fell in love, and the rest is kind of history.
It's amazing how that just completely changes your life.
Oh, doesn't it? Yeah. And was on a trajectory, I think, that I probably, in a roundabout way, would have ended up in a similar place at the stage I'm at in my career.
Mm-hmm.
But as a result of our relationship, our children, and who we are here in Port Waikato, have managed to be exposed to many amazing things and opportunities that I would have never even thought of.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Awesome.
Yeah, so that's me. I've got three tamariki, two whāngai and one biological one who's just gone off to uni. And we're at that next stage, which is the other extreme, where we've got no children at home now.
Yeah.
And we're like really excited.
Okay. I remember from my parents, my mum says, Paul, I still haven't forgiven you for leaving home. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, you have to leave home and then your kids come back again just as you get used to it, of course. I'm heading down to Christchurch tomorrow for my dad's retirement. And that's been really interesting. He's been a dentist in the same practice, doing the same kind of work for 35 years. And my brother and I laugh because he's on his third career and I've lost count as well. And so, yeah, we're having a send-off for him and mum to say, you know, thank you for all your hard mahi over so many years, and you know, we're grateful for what it's enabled us to be able to do as well. I think you got to mark those sorts of things. So yeah, for you that's quite a big shift when your kids go and a role that you've had for so long changes.
Definitely. And I think too, as we're making those decisions about where to stay and where to live and which opportunities we take up, that when you have your tamariki in your focus is your priority, it definitely shapes your priorities really, really early on. And I think for our relationship, the strength of it has become, you know, being so focused on our whānau and our family that over the years it's become, you know, you do it without even thinking about it.
Mm.
And in but terms of what you
do, how did that focus on whānau change or impact on your career journey?
That's a really good question, isn't it? So when I met my tāne Reece, I'd just finished my law degree and done profs, so the entry into practice for law. And we were contemplating where and who I was going to work for. And at that time, my daughter came into our lives. And I think the lure of going and having a corporate career in a law firm quickly became apparent that wasn't going to work for us.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, parents offered to raise our daughter, actually, so I could pursue it if I wanted to, you know, and for us, whānau is just it's a privilege and a natural part of who we are, you know, raising our children with our parents. So my parents made that offer to us, but we decided for us, keeping everyone together was our priority. So sort of abandoned that aspiration that I had to practice law. And ended up at Public Trust, of all places, mainly because there was an office in Pukekohe, which is just there on the road from Port Waikato.
Again, the randomness of life events impacting your career. But do you look back on that and feel a what if, or do you look back and go, oh, feel like that actually set me on such a good path?
I think no regrets at all. But I've actually found that the tools that law has provided have been useful in so many other ways that I didn't even possibly fathom at the time. I think we think about law and, you know, and they use it all the time in a vacuum, that it is practicing or, you know, contracting or, you know, in the specific tools that we use in law, but actually it's so much more useful in other ways in terms of how we see and manage things in our reality. I found it really, really useful working with community as well in terms of some of the tools that it set me up with there as well.
I mean, it's a way of thinking about society, about people. I studied law as well, did the prof's exam and haven't practiced. So I'm similar to you, you know, and every so often I'll be doing something and I'll go, oh, I'm so grateful for that. You know, I struggled through it at the time, but it shows up again in different ways. And I mean, you've had a career of a little bit like me, actually, as like a smorgasbord career, I call it, where it's like, oh, that looks yummy. I'm going to try some of that. I'm going to work in an organization, oh, now I'll jump out, I'll be a consultant, and I'm going to work for private sector, oh, no, now public, now community. Like you've kind of had a little bit of all of that. And I guess that's why you're such a perfect person at Weave, where you're the person in between, like that connecting space. So maybe take us now into a little bit about your entrance into Weave as an organization and how that happened.
No, definitely. I love the way you describe that. I think at times I'm sort of, how do you describe my career? That's a really, really great way of doing it. But I guess I'm always attracted to the work and maybe the people that I'm working with rather than where that's going to progress me to into the next role I should theoretically be doing. So that's always been my priority, the work. And the people that I'm working with. Weave, oh, that's a good story. I was actually in Taranaki at the time.
Right.
And I was homesick. So I'd left working in the DHB and by chance, not got roped, but asked by a colleague to come and provide some support down in Taranaki. And it was an amazing paying job, doing all the sorts of work I love doing with iwi. Except it didn't have my whānau there with me. And so I was traveling back and forth. So what I did is I jumped on LinkedIn one day, like you do, and this role came up out of the ether in the digital universe. And I thought, wow, that just sounds so me. I can work remotely. Don't we love that? And enough variety in there to definitely keep me busy and sink my teeth into with our change of strategic direction. The other attraction was also Tyndall Foundation. So they'd previously funded different work I'd been involved in, and I thought they were an amazing foundation. So I thought, well, if they're all together, they're probably going to be neat too. So yeah, that's how we ended up applying, and it was a bit of a whirlwind process. And sort of 2 months after that, I was working for Weave.
Just like that. And a pretty cool time to come in as well. So for people listening who don't know, Weave used to be the Working Together More Fund. Correct me if I get some details wrong here, but it was about 10 years ago. There were four of those big family foundations came together, looked at what can we do to make the funding system work more effectively. And one of the things they thought was, how do we better support collaboration where it's happening? And so the Working Together More Fund was the first version of that. And this is partly why I was so keen to have you on the show, actually, that the initial spark was when I saw the Working Together More Fund had become Weave. And I was going, oh, okay, well, what's happening then? What's the change of direction? So what was that? How did that happen?
You did a really good summary. I might just have to store that in the back of my head when I meet people and tell them about Weave and the Working Together More Fund. So, yeah, been around a little bit longer. So back established in 2009 and came out of the financial crisis as well at the time that was across what was going on in the world. So there was a bit of research done around the power that collaboration can provide in circumstances when we're facing things like the financial crisis. So originally 4 members, today we've got 8. Uh-huh. And the reason I came on board, they sought to appoint a general manager. They just decided to collectively support a change of direction and look at funding collaboration in the systems change space. Okay. So prior to me starting, we used to do 3 grant rounds per year, lots of small grants for organisations looking to collaborate.
Right.
And so the shift was really a dynamic, progressive one to address need that they saw and wanting to work on longer term projects and also develop deeper relationships with our communities as well.
Okay, so shifting from lots of smaller, you know, here's 5K, 15K to spark this new working relationship to a smaller number of deeper collaborative efforts. And I mean, you mentioned wanting to take more of a systems change approach. What does that mean to you at Weave?
Oh, that's a good question too, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I guess also the beautiful part of this journey, because we're sort of coming into year 2 of the change, I came in as we were doing the reset of strategic direction. We very much let the communities that we're working with define that for them.
Yeah.
But we're looking to support change to address some of these really big meaty issues at the beginning rather than the end stage of where things are at. So again, if we say, for example, took Match as an example, we were talking briefly when I came on. The idea behind that platform is doing is something about the imbalances, the power imbalances that often exist in the funding sector between very small charities and those really large ones that we know about that have quite massive resources.
Mm.
So from a systems change perspective to do with Match, it's about doing something about those imbalances. How do we support communities at grassroots who are doing phenomenal work, get access to maybe funders that they wouldn't know about and vice versa? So that from our perspective is systems change work, addressing what's happening in the funding sector.
Yeah. And the most helpful definition for me of systems change is working on the conditions that hold a problem in place. So there, the conditions that are holding the problem in place are the big organizations. And I read a stat actually when I was doing the research for this podcast, it was like 90-odd% of funding goes to 9 charities, I think it was, something like that, which just blew my mind. I didn't realize it was that intense. So there, the systems change is actually making it more easy and accessible for smaller organizations to be able to access those same kind of opportunities. So how do you at Weave, when you're, I mean, you must have so many different places that you could intervene in a system. How do you decide where there is a role for you and where there isn't?
That's also a very great question and something that we've been grappling with. I guess something that maybe people don't know about Weave is even our makeup is a collaboration and quite dynamic in the sense of we have management, CEOs, general managers, and trustees sitting around the decision-making table for Weave, which is a little bit unique.
Yeah.
But again, we've made a few changes to help identify that. And so the process has helped work towards the outcomes that we're starting to get now. So by changing to a proactive relationship-based funder, that enables us to not waste the time of community applying for funding or grants and things of that nature, but it allows me to go out and work with community and go out and work with our partners to find and identify possible points where we can invest or support with Weave's resources, which I think is really, really pivotal in terms of where we're going and helping prioritise what's important. The other thing we do often is work with others as well with co-funding opportunities,
right,
and at the early stages as well. So even though we used to do lots of small grants, we do still provide seed funding for fantastic ideas around collaboration that might need a bit of a kickstart as well. The idea is from that point, we support through a planning process to develop a plan about how those organisations might want to work together on a system change element. And then that's presented to our decision makers, and we get to kanohi to kanohi as well. So everyone comes to the table to discuss the vision and the support that's needed.
When
so
you say everyone, is that the people applying for the funding who've been through that process as well?
So I think that's a huge opportunity, because even getting for a small community group or community collaborations, getting from that seed funding start place where you have an amazing idea to a place where you can pitch it, for want of a better word, start to develop relationships, it opens so many doors, but the capacity and capability element that comes from that is phenomenal for community as well.
Yeah, and you're essentially, your application process in itself is teaching them about collaboration, so that when they go out or back into the real world after that, they've got a process and a set of principles to then, that are kind of their starting point. Is that part of the thinking?
I think it's that, but it's even more than that, that they help shape our processes and teach us equally as much. Because I think this has been a change where we thought it might be look like this, A, B, and C, and it turned out to be X, Y, and Z.
Okay.
So I guess that's the beauty of working within that family philanthropy space, that, yes, our trusts and foundations have the parameters that they have to operate, you know, work within their trusts.
Right.
But we create a space with Weave where the possibilities and scope of what we can do is almost infinite in a way, and have a lot more freedom than, say, a crown entity that I've worked with in the past that's regulated quite heavily around how and what and where you can fund. This allows a way to maybe try things differently and be the things we want to see in the processes that we're enacting and supporting with. I very much take a wraparound support, be the thing I need to be with our group that we're working with, which they really appreciate, and I equally appreciate from them too.
And you mentioned some assumptions that have been overturned. You thought you needed ABC and turns out you needed D, E, and F. What are those assumptions that were quite different in reality from what you expected?
So I think when we started this change in direction, we were looking to maybe fund up to 10 seed funding, you know, collaborations per year.
Right.
And actually, in that first year, we did 6. And, you know, we had a number of other things we were doing at the same time. But if you think logistically about what goes into collaboration and community as well, when we're working with a mixture of volunteers and limited resources, trying to get even to a point where we have everything for everyone takes a lot of time and investment in relationships. I met with a group the other day with a really new young and up and coming CEO, and he was kept talking about the importance of authentic relationships. No, not being transactional, that we're here for this part, but taking the time to build relationships that are enduring and relevant and meet the needs of everyone. So we strive a lot for that, and that takes a bit of time. And I guess the other challenge was, is because we work nationally as well. We had groups in the South Island and some in the North Island, and also COVID. COVID was interesting.
How do you get people working together more closely when they cannot work together more closely?
Oh, exactly. And I think what we did too was adapted in a way that we looked as funders to work more collaboratively as well. So we had quite a bit of work happening where we were co-funding and collaborating on big issues like COVID as well. So we've got our own work, the work we do with other organisations. We're not just ourselves in terms of family philanthropy. We're looking across the spectrum and also thinking about how we can support or add value in different points as well.
Yeah, I imagine this must be pretty fascinating work for you. And one aspect of it that I'm interested in diving into more is like the power dynamic of being a funder. And I know for you, there's a personal commitment to equity and also for Weave as well. So what are you thinking through and working through, both in terms of your role as someone who holds resource and mana within that funding system? How do you approach that?
Good question. I think for us as Weave the organisation, we've made a conscious effort to think about what we're doing about that and the role that equity plays within that. So your question and your timing's perfect. So we're just in the process of developing an equity framework at the moment that will help support the decision-making process.
How did you go about developing that framework?
I went out and basically, because my background before coming to Weave, I was the portfolio manager for funding and equity at Counties Manukau DHB.
Right.
So I've had a bit of experience in the Crown space, but also working with iwi Māori in our communities, it's made me think about practically what can we do right now and what tools do our decision makers need. So we've drawn on maybe best practice within philanthropy, frameworks that I've seen work well within the government and not-for-profit space to develop something sort of bespoke for Weave, where we look at four steps. What do we need as a committee and decision makers? And then we go into examining the different pillars and work streams that we've got. So we're not just funding. We've also got resources that we provide, training that we support, and action that we're doing. So then running an equity lens over that work, and then also examining the work that we're wanting to do in the future. So at the very beginning part of that journey at the moment, but looking at, so if we're trying to create change that is meaningful for collaboration, what are the other things that we need to consider when having relationships with each other and the groups that we're working with, but also decisions around resources, funding, things of that nature.
Right. So that's your step one, is looking internally at what we need, and then from there?
So step two would be examining, you know, the work that we're doing at the moment. Who are the communities that most need support, and using an equity lens in respect of that, those four work streams that I was talking about. And then going back, also the other part of this framework that I've helped develop for Weave is also thinking about in the past, where or how could we do things to enable work with communities who are most impacted by inequities within what we're doing as well. So that's also a really important piece. But I don't really just say it as a set of questions. Often people use like things like heat tools or questions about allocation of resources and whether we're getting the funding to the right people. I really think that for decision makers to make amazing decisions that support the aspirations we're trying to achieve, they need to have the right tools as well and training. And so that's very, very much going to be part of our process as well.
And I'm getting a sense of it's not just a framework, it's actually something you're trying to build in different ways. So like those four steps that you're talking through, What's the timeline for that? Is that every month we're going through those four steps, every year? How does that work at the moment?
So we're just very much at the beginning, Paul. So yeah, we're having a workshop in June to fish out all of those sorts of things. So we literally just met 2 weeks ago to start thinking about those sorts of things. So still very much at the beginning of the journey. But there is a general commitment across all of our foundations and trusts that this is a priority for us and in their own foundations. I guess the challenging part is how we do it collectively when we've got eight very different organisations sitting at our table to ensure that we're supporting collaborative change and that vision that we have as an organisation.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe for you personally, you know, you were sharing about where you fuck a papa to and how important that connection between whānau and mahi is for you. Like you can't disconnect that. And so I'm wondering, what are your personal hopes and dreams for how Weave might be able to better support flourishing te ao Māori culture and ways of being?
I think too, that's really important. And you know, part of coming to this work was there was a little bit of a blank slate to be able to create a space where all our collective dreams, not only mine, but our foundations as well, about how we have relationships with our community and te ao Māori in a meaningful way. That's, you know, they talk a lot in philanthropy about high trust. And this is very much what we practice in building those relationships. But I guess for me, it's about powering up our whānau and our community to be the best versions of themselves as per our aspirations. We're working in a whānau hapū iwi level. I think having worked in that treaty space as well for a time, I could see for the amount of resource and what a settlement process might produce, there must be other ways that are faster and better to be able to support the aspirations of our whānau and iwi as well. So I was lucky to work with a man by the name of Victor Main, and he taught me a lot about, before co-design was a thing, about how we develop solutions with iwi and hapū that are led by them. To address the problems that they might be facing in terms of environmental issues through them, through the courts, or what's some other meaty things that we've worked on, things to do with the river and sustainability of river and how we practice kaitiakitanga in a way that gets the things that we need to do right now, but also upholds the aspirations of our tūpuna as well. So spent a bit of time on the ground working with our people and thinking about what is it that we need and how can we partner in a meaningful way to support those aspirations. I don't think that's any different than like whether I'm working with Weave or even when I've worked in Crown agencies, prioritising the things that are most important to that particular community or whānau or iwi. So for me, the initial work that we've done, we've worked with a wider collaboration of funders, working with kaupapa Māori organisations who needed support during COVID.
Right. How did that come about?
Oh, a need. And hey, Natalia, we think it's a good idea. So I got invited to a meeting. And again, at the time, it was a bit odd because it was all online. And as we do, often philanthropic funders come together when there's a cause like COVID or the floods or the cyclones we're facing at the moment and thought, you know, what can we do right at this moment? So the decision was to support kaupapa Māori organisations during COVID. And through that process, we ended up doing some really amazing things with at times 14 plus funders and groups throughout the Motu who were leading their COVID responses within Māori communities. And I guess for us, it's really hard to develop a relationship via Zoom, where you might normally go to a marae or Kaupapa Māori service providers are. So having the opportunity to bring them to us via technology like and Zoom to hear about what was needed and what support they had at the moment was really empowering for them, because normally what happens a lot in funding is you put out, this is what we're looking for, or these are the priorities of our fund. For this particular response to our Māori communities, they told us what we need, what they needed, and then we figured out how we would support them.
Yeah. And I mean, if you were to do the same kind of process today, would you do it virtually again? Or like, did that work so well virtually that you go, actually, there were benefits to that, or you still prefer to do it in person?
I think, Paul, whenever you have the opportunity to be able to come together with people, ākanohi, you know, in person, that's a privilege and also creates a connection there that you can't really beat. But, you know, when you're forced to do things by home and you've got a really remote community on the East Coast who you can't get access to, you know, when there's an internet connection, that creates an amazing opportunity to be able to progress things maybe at a speed that you wouldn't normally be able to do if you needed to have a series of hui or wānanga to sort something out in person. So I guess my preference is always to meet with people in person when I can. So we can do this in terms of, you know, when we've had the opportunity to get to know each other a bit better via Zoom. But also sometimes you'll go there for one particular kaupapa and actually find these five other things that are completely related and connect up to the work anyway. So I think that's one of the beautiful things about meeting in person.
Yeah, it's the unexpected conversation over a cup of tea, or when you're wandering down to the gate or cleaning up and doing the dishes. Sometimes that's where the real magic is.
Oh, definitely.
Look, for people listening, a lot of whom they're working in some of those organizations that you've been in where they might not have as much freedom as you do. They might be listening going, oh, lucky her, you know, she's got this group of funders who are open-minded and wanting to do things a little bit differently. But from your diversity of experience, what tips or advice do you have for people who are looking to maybe fund differently, to support collaboration that, you know, might not be possible at the moment? What advice have you got for them?
I've had it my sister likes to point out, oh, you tend to springboard back and forth between, you know, government, mainstream, kaupapa Māori, that sort of thing. But I guess I've had a bit of success creating change at a really small scale and testing it out first before you maybe can implement it on a larger scale. And especially working within government, you'll often find those really brilliant leaders who desperately want to do things differently, but just need a little bit of hand or a bit of a plan to maybe work on one particular area. You know, what can we do right now? And then they become the advocate for you that you might need at a different leadership level than you're sitting at. But I've also found that when you're new and coming into an organisation and you don't know any better, that's the best time to ask all sorts of questions about why we're doing things the way we are.
It's funny how we, over time, convince ourselves that we can no longer ask those questions. But we do,
And I think, like, one of the interesting things when I first went into health, getting my head around the government sourcing rules, because I needed to get private funding through a public organisation to be able to get to community where we needed it most. That in itself, you know, it doesn't sound that hard if you don't know any better. It's actually really, really hard. You know, when you understand procurement rules and sourcing and contracting teams and all the steps that need to happen. But actually, through pushing the boundaries of what the rules say you can do and asking those questions about, actually, if we did it this way, wouldn't that be better for community and also create efficiencies for us? And when you understand the barriers, addressing each of those barriers. And so when you get rid of the barriers, what's getting in the way now? So I've done a bit of that over the years as well. And that's where I guess the law and even the psychology degree I did as well come in handy. Because again, gives you another set of tools to help you understand why things are the way they are.
And you're making it sound easy, but in the moment, those conversations are not often that easy, because often you're coming into conflict with different values as well. That's what can be really hard. I value this, communities value this, you're talking about something different. So yeah, there's no simple equation to how those things work, is there?
No, but the other thing I think I found really useful, and I still do this, is sometimes if you get an expert in that is highly regarded by the people you're working for at the time, and they say the same thing that you're trying to say, maybe in a slightly different way, that can actually create traction as well. Because having an external perspective, sharing the value that they have found or the ways that they do, can create change also a lot quicker just by it being a different person. So I mean, you know, I often try and find people like that to help, especially when you hit roadblocks and stuff and you're trying to change
things. I love that. Yep, I can see how that would just spark a different conversation as well.
And it's that helps build that coalition of the willing that we often talk about, because through those conversations and sometimes someone a little bit different from outside of the organization coming in, talking about it, then it can resonate with people who maybe you didn't even think cared about that particular issue or something that you were changing at the time. So yeah, injecting really clever people like that at different points, I found really, really helpful as well.
Nice. I like it. Hey, well, I'm aware of our time, Natalia, and wondering if there's anything else you'd like to share with people listening.
I was just thinking about that. I guess for me and sort of the work that I've been involved in, every time I get a little bit, not disenfranchised, but maybe going, what the heck am I doing right now? I lean really heavily on what our ancestors and tupuna have said. So I find a lot of sense of connection when I look to traditional knowledge. My tane is a carver as well, so he's into Whakaero, and I guess even though we're completely different, the thing that brings us together is our love of te ao Māori and also how clever our ancestors were. And I think as you get older, you start going, oh, actually, someone already thought of that and looked at that really clever, you know, navigator or astronomer or someone who was saying that hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So I think, you know, looking back on that wisdom is really, really, really good when you hit things that are difficult. The other one I'm thinking
for you, where do you find that?
Reading.
Yeah.
I read a lot. I'm lucky, I love on a papakainga as well, so I'm actually surrounded by lots of really cool older wise people. But you know, at different times different things pop up. I was looking at a really amazing Toi Māori book on the exhibition that I think it was Nigel Burrell curated. There's this amazing book, and at the front you'd look and there'd be phenomenal Indigenous art, but the foreword was done by Mauna Jackson, who's like a, you know, legal Indigenous amazing scholar. And you'd think, oh, what the heck is he doing curating this book on Indigenous art when he is a Māori, you know, legal scholar who's done phenomenal things? And I guess what he was saying in his introduction in a really summarised way is that, you know, art is a reflection of who we are, people. And he was also reflecting on the history of art in Aotearoa and the role it's played in advocating for the rights of our people, but also expressing who we are in a really amazing way. And so found a lot of value in that, even though at the moment, say, we're working on an equity framework. it inspires me to think about maybe what would our tupuna do? How do we see or realise the aspirations that we have for our world here and realize that in the work that we're doing, even if the work plays a really small part in that, but actually making that change and doing things differently has lots of consequences and flow-on effects for lots of people. So being the change that you want to see, people say that all the time, but I try and practice that in the work that we're doing.
Oh, kia ora. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm reminded of a saying, I don't know who came up with it, but it's something like, everything has already been said, it's just that we weren't listening. And so I'm hearing from you, like, this daily or weekly practice of listening to your tupuna and then putting that into practice in your day. So I can see how that's powerful. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's that, but also realizing, you know, how I talked about relationships, how important they are, not only from, you know, that being authentic place, but also recognizing that everything has a whakapapa. In Te Ao Māori, we know that and we live that and we breathe that, but also in our mahi, when we sort of unpick where the work has come from and understand why it's that way, understand the whakapapa of it, that actually the solutions come from that reviewing process and going back before going forward as well.
Well, thank you so much for sharing a little bit about you and your whānau and the story of Weave. And yeah, I really enjoyed hearing the process that you've been under as an organization over the last, not just the last 2 years, but in particular the last 2 years for you, of asking the hard questions of yourselves of why are we doing this work? How can we do it better? What are we learning? Yeah, it's been really insightful to just get a little bit of a glimpse into what that has been like for you.
Oh, awesome. I'm glad. And I guess the thing that's beautiful about us is that often when collaboration can be challenging and dynamic, it is for us as well, and realizing that that's a good thing for lots of reasons. And so, you know, I'm a big advocate for collaboration, but actually the beauty sometimes is that process or the way we're doing it and the light that comes as a result as well, you know, unexpected consequences, learnings, growings that influence change as we go forward.
Oh, kia ora. Thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond Consultation. And what now? Well, I've got three suggestions for you. Firstly, go and check out the show notes in your podcast player or on the Business Lab or Learning Lab website so you can see the resources that were shared in the show. Secondly, send a message to our guests. It's really nice when you've been a guest in this slightly nerve-wracking experience, and then people get in touch to thank you for sharing your stories and experiences. And lastly, do connect with me on LinkedIn. I view LinkedIn as an ongoing conference, you know, this amazing way to be exposed to new people and new ideas that can stretch and enhance your practice. So that's it for today's episode. Thank you again for listening. Ngā mihi mō te whakaroa.